Hi, this is Sarah O'Kelly with Skipper's Review, and I'm here today with a woman who chose to take a different path than, say, what society expected of her. A path that brought adventure and courage, love, freedom, independence, and pretty worldly knowledge. I'm here with Pam Wall. So welcome to Boat Radio.
Well, Sarah, thank you. It's really nice to meet you, and I always like to share the joys that I've had in my life while I've been on this, as you say, this life of adventure.
I can't wait to hear them. And what I really want to do is I want to start with when you were a child. I feel it's so fascinating to me how you have become and did the things that you do with the freedom that you did them. And I feel it all kind of starts with childhood. What were your parents like?
Yeah, I really agree with you. I was very lucky. I grew up in the suburbs, the northern suburbs of Chicago, and we always lived right by the lake. We used to say, I live by the lake drop-in, Lake Michigan, that is. And I had two sisters, an older sister and a younger sister, so I was in the middle. And I had adventurous parents, and they were the kind of parents who would come and knock on the door of our schools Thursday afternoon and sort of motion to us to come to the door, and we'd all jump in the car, and they'd have all the skis and all the clothes ready, and we'd drive up to some Boyne Mountain or Wausau or you know, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and spend the weekend skiing, and then maybe they'd bring us back home Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday, and we'd miss some school. But this is how I remember my youth, is always on adventure. I mean, one time my dad had a car that he had to deliver from Chicago to Los Angeles, and we spent 3 weeks in this magnificent, huge car, driving, we sort of crisscrossed the United States north to south, you know, seeing things like the Grand Canyon, the Rio Grande, Disney World, Sun Valley, Idaho. Then we finally dropped the car off in Los Angeles. That's the kind of thing my dad and my mom did. And my sisters, you know, it was just a fact of life for us. It was just the way we lived. My dad was also a very keen racing sailor. And he always had sailboats that he kept in Chicago, at Chicago Yacht Club and Columbia Yacht Club. And he always wanted to win, okay? And he would buy a new boat, a new design that he thought would win. It would win pretty well for 2 or 3 years, and then he'd sell it and get the next design. My poor mother was always going crazy because she'd just get familiar with the boat and love it. You know,
done.
All her stuff
Move
aboard.
On.
Yeah. And my dad would sell it and get something else. And so our summers, and of course that was only summer, were spent on Lake Michigan and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And we knew that we were going to go cruising for the summer months all the time. And I always dreamed of kind of meeting a man who would sweep me off my feet and sail me around the world. And I'm sure it was because of that wonderful experience that my parents gave me as a young girl.
No doubt.
As a matter of fact, there were three things in my life before I was 16 that I knew I wanted. One was I wanted to see Bally High from the movie South Pacific. Okay. That was my favorite movie. The other one is that someday I wanted to swim with dolphins, okay? And the third one was to sail around the world, okay, with my husband, you know. Those were the three things that I... And you know what? I was very lucky. I got to do all three of them.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. It is. And, you know, when I was reading to my children, when we crossed the Pacific, my children were very young. And I'll come back to that later, but this is another thing that I had to do in my life. And we had, every afternoon, we'd call it going to the movies. And we'd sit in the cockpit while the boat was self-steering, and I would read a good book to them, and just a chapter a day. And we'd have a popcorn, and we called that going to the movies, because back then there was no such thing as computers or anything. And I remember the first book I read was Swiss Family Robinson, about this family that's cast away on a beach and everything. And the other thing my children wanted to do was to ride ostriches from the movie Swiss Family Robinson. And we got to do that as well. So
wow.
I passed that sort of thing on to my children. Anyway, I grew up in Chicago sailing with my dad in the summer and skiing in the winter. And
was your mom just as adventurous, or was she just kind of doing it along for the ride?
No, she was just as adventurous, although not quite like my dad. I think she probably would have preferred a more sedentary life, probably. But when she got going, you know, it was trying to organize a family of five, you know, to always go somewhere with either ski clothes or bathing suits, you know. But I think she really enjoyed it. I think she really enjoyed it. And I think the proof of it was that when Andy and I, my husband and I, built our boat and sailed it around the world, she would come to visit us. She would fly and stay with us on this boat. And believe me, it was not the kind of boat she was used to, because our boat is very simple. She was used to, you know, having much more luxury. And she used to laugh when we were up a stream doing our laundry on the rocks and say, if my friends in Chicago could see me now, they think I'm on the Queen Mary, you know. They wouldn't believe what life is like, you know, cruising simply the way your family does. Anyway, so I grew up there, and I went to University of Wisconsin, and I did a lot of sailing on Lake Mendota, and I knew that I did not want to live where it was going to be cold. I just knew that. I knew I wanted to be someplace where I could sail all year round. So I graduated from University of Wisconsin, and with my parents' blessings, I drove down to Fort Lauderdale. I found a place to live. I got a wonderful job, and
this was like in the 60s?
Yeah. So I packed my dog up and my bikinis, and I got in my car and I drove down to Fort Lauderdale. And luckily I found a house on the water, and I've been here ever since. And that was 1966.
So that was 1966. So this was a time really for women where women were in the workplace, but it wasn't equality. It wasn't the same amount of pay. The thing that was expected of you was to have a family, have children, and take care of your husband pretty much. It was still in that, which is hard to believe. So the fact that you took this route of complete independence and said, I'm not doing any of that, I'm heading down south to Fort Lauderdale to see what's down there. What were your plans when you were going to come down to Fort Lauderdale?
To tell you the truth, I have no idea, but you're so right, because many of my friends that I grew up with in the Chicago area married in that community, lived in that community, and always have stayed in that community. And there's nothing wrong with that. No, I it's funny, I just had a calling that I wanted to get south and be where there was sailing year round. And but you're right, I mean, the first job I had was as a travel agent. I mean, I couldn't make any money, but it was fun to talk to people who were traveling. Mm-hmm. And then I became a yacht broker that worked only on commission. And because I was only 20, nobody thought I knew anything about boats, although I did. So I never sold a boat, but I tried really hard.
And being a woman and being 20, probably.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, and I was with a bunch of men who were yacht brokers, you know. And I was just the cute girl in the office, mm-hmm. you know. But if I hadn't been a yacht broker, I never would have met my husband, because I saw him out the window walking down a dock. You know, so it was serendipity that I got these poor paying jobs. But at least I was where I wanted to be. And my father always had a boat down here. Even though mm-hmm. he didn't live here yet, he got a boat and kept it over at Pier 66 Marina. And he got a series of boats called Pam's Pony. You know, as a young girl, I always wanted a horse. Always wanted a horse. Did a lot of horseback riding with my dad. And it was a joke with him. I'd get you a horse anytime. And he would buy me boats. And he'd always name them Pam's Pony, because he wasn't passionate about horses, but he was about boats, you know. So I'm going to get my child, but I want her to have, you know. So I had
in a roundabout
way. Boats called Pam's Pony. I had a couple of them down here too. So it was different. There weren't a lot of women down here sailing at all. There was a few other women yacht brokers who were doing very well, but they'd been established for many years. And they weren't young as I was. But I didn't have to worry, because through chance and magic, I met Andy, and we took off. And
So you met Andy. You met him. He was walking by the dock. You said, hi. And he said, what's up?
Yeah, well, it's the old story. You know, they say, I like the cut of his jib. Yeah. You know, that's, which means I like the way he looked.
Right.
And I saw him, and I ran out, and I just introduced myself to him and found out what he was doing at that point in his life. He had just sailed his 30-foot boat. He had built his own boat in Australia. Sailed it around Cape Horn in 1966. He was the first Australian cruising yacht to sail around Cape Horn in a 30-foot boat. And when
So you immediately had something in common that you could get a conversation going and talk
exactly.
about.
Exactly. And he was the captain, funny enough, on a beautiful boat called Escapade, which was a famous racing boat, big racing boat, that, funny enough, was owned by a really good friend of mine and a friend of my dad's. And so I asked him if I could help him deliver the boat from Fort Lauderdale to Miami, because he told me he was leaving the next day. And he said, if you want to come with me, you can. And I thought, better do it. You know? So we sailed this beautiful boat, Escapade, down to Miami. And that's how it all began. And
beautiful.
He asked me if he could bring his boat to my dock, because his boat was down in Miami. And of course, I was so lucky. I had just bought the house with a dock. So it's a big joke with him that I've paid for that dock for the rest of my life. You know. So he brought his boat here. He was here for 2 years. The boat was always here, but he did a lot of yacht deliveries, big yacht deliveries. Some of them I did with him, which was really fun. And finally...
when you say yacht delivery, so it would be from, say, Miami up to all the way up to New York, or where would you deliver to? All over the place.
Or down to Honduras, from Miami to Honduras, or a big delivery he had on Escapade was from Miami up through the Erie Barge Canal and back to the Great Lakes.
So you're doing what you love and you're getting paid for it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
And was it always sailboats, or was it?
Always sailboats, yeah. And down to the Caribbean, a couple of times we went from Fort Lauderdale down to Grenada together on a big, these are all big boats, you know, with people who didn't want to have to take them themselves. Mm-hmm. So they got a captain and I would go along, you know, sort of mate. I never got paid, but I was with Andy. That was my payment. And that was
absolutely.
Like $1 million.
Yeah.
And then finally, he said, come on, let's cross the Atlantic. And I want to get over to Europe. And I said, there's only one way I can go with you, Andy. He said, okay, let's go get married. You know, typical Australian.
Yeah.
And we went to it just as the peace and got married and took off for 3 years in this tiny little 30-foot boat. But Sarah, if I could describe this boat to you, it was 30 feet long. I'm 4'11". I'm the only person who could stand up in it. He couldn't, you know, he was 6'3". He had to bend over to get down below. It had no toilet. It had a big bucket. It had one burner kerosene stove. I slept on the cabin sole because the boat was so tiny. And this is the boat he had taken around Cape Horn, this tiny little boat.
This is the man who knew what he was doing.
Yeah, yeah. And we had a ball, the two of us. We sailed over to Europe. It was a big learning experience for me, but because Andy never wanted to be a captain. He wanted us to be together, do everything together. He just had the most wonderful way of, I wouldn't even call it teaching, just having you assimilate what he knew because he wanted to share it. So by the time I got to Bermuda, I was a pretty good sailor, and by the time I got to the Azores, I was a really good sailor. And by the time we got to England, I mean, I was pretty accomplished, and he could feel very comfortable, you know, with me going anywhere. And so we sailed around Europe for those 3 years, and then we knew we wanted to have children, and he knew that that boat would sink with another potato chip on it, you know. So we sailed the boat back across the Atlantic. And
did you get caught in any kind of storms or anything when you're doing this sailing backwards and forwards from Atlantic?
Of course you do. But when you have someone who knows what they're doing and you have total confidence in your boat and total confidence in who you're sailing with, it's not frightening at all. It's challenging. And kind of when it's over, you go, whew, that was exciting, wasn't it? Instead of, oh, that was terrifying. It was just exciting. So sure, you have a lot of bad weather. Don't forget, in those days, there was no electronic navigation. There was no communication. None. Zero. Unless you yelled. And there was no weather information. You know, you took off and you dealt with what you were, you know, given. You know, you just... It was a time, you know, they used to say when ships were wood and men were steel, and Andy was made of steel, you know, and luckily he passed that on to me, I think, a lower grade of steel, but he was the best. So we came home, and another friend of ours, an Australian friend, wanted to buy our little boat from us. And he knew of a very famous Australian design called a Freya, that the boat Freya had won the Sydney Hobart race, which at that time was the most difficult race anyone could be in, because it's a high latitude race, you know. And Andy had always admired the Freya design. And there was a young man out in California, Australian, who had built a mold for a Freya, but nobody would buy hull number one.
Hmm.
So with the cash in our hand for our little 30-foot boat, we borrowed my sister's car because we didn't have a car. We came home penniless. But we sold the boat, so we had this sort of lump sum of very little. Borrowed my sister's car and drove out to California and laid up the hull for my present boat, Ken Darrick. And
wow.
Took 10 years to finish her. You know, we built that boat from scratch. And at the same time, we were both working. Andy was always a sailboat rigger.
So this 10-year span where you're not going anywhere? You're building this boat?
Oh, no, we were building the boat, and every summer we take it away someplace. Maine, Jamaica, Bahamas. But there
so
was
it wasn't ready yet,
more.
But you take it.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, our daughter Samantha, when she was born, slept in a cardboard box in the turn of the bilge because there was no cabin, so, you know. It was very, very primitive in the beginning, and of course every summer that we would go away had a little bit more luxury, you know, a little bit more, and the boat still isn't finished.
And you're learning the exact design that you want since you're actually
exactly.
Using it.
And we changed a lot of things too, you know, we realized that we made mistakes and we changed them. So the boat was always a work in progress, and to tell you the truth, Sarah, it still is. I mean, she never got finished because Andy passed away. He never got to finish her the way he wanted to. But she is a thoroughbred, built by a master craftsman, and with all his great ideas for being a very seaworthy, safe, and fast cruising boat.
And makes the most of a little space you have.
Yes, exactly. And comfortable space, you know, a safe space. And so I'm trying to do my best to keep her like he would want her to be kept. You know, and I think you think from the pictures you saw, she's pretty.
Oh, she's beautiful.
She's something like 42 years old now, and she's
like brand new. Yeah.
Yeah, but she's not finished.
Of course not.
Anyway, so that's what happened. We went over to Europe, came home, started building the boat, had two gorgeous children while we were working, and.
And where were you when you were pregnant and gave birth?
I was home still.
Oh, you're still in America?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was still here. We were both working. I worked for a sail loft, Mack Shaw Sailmakers.
Mm-hmm.
I ran their office. I can't sew a stitch, but I ran the office. And I had two children while I was working for them.
Would they go to work with you? Or
pardon me?
Would the kids go to work with you, or what you do with them while you were
no,
working?
No, Andy would babysit them because he was here.
Oh, he's working
on
this.
On the boat, and I'd come home every 4 hours, nurse, you know. I made it for a schedule. 8 o'clock, I nursed. I went to work. I got there at 9. 1 o'clock, I'd come home and nurse. And then I left work at 4. I mean, we had to do it that way. And it was kind of funny because a lady down the street said, I really wonder how your daughter's going to turn out and your son. Because they were brought up by their father. And we always had friends staying at our dock. Young, nice guys.
So they're very social.
Yes,
a lot,
right.
Yeah.
Who all, you know, became... sort of godfathers of our children, you know. I had nothing to do with bringing them up when they were babies. These three guys did, you know, mm-hmm. Three or four guys if they were all here. It was kind of fun, you know. And so it was a wonderful experience. And then finally Andy said to me, when our daughter was 7 and our son was 4, I could keep working on this boat for another 10 years. But let's get out of here. Let's go. Let's do it while we can. Let's do it while we're young. Let's do it while they're young. Boat is far enough along that we can live on her comfortably. She's not what I want to have her in the end, but she's far enough.
And you could work on her while you're on the road, too,
yeah, we
right?
Could have
or on the,
to, yeah.
Not the road,
except
the ocean.
Way too much fun, yeah. Anyway, so we rented our house and took off, and my son Jamie was 4, and my daughter Samantha was 7 when we left. And we told my parents, who really wanted to go with us, they were so cute, you know, when they said goodbye to us, oh, God, I wish we could come too, you know. We told them we'd be back in 2 years, but it wasn't for 6.5 years that we came. You know, but my mom came to visit us quite often. She came to Papeete in Tahiti and stayed with us for 6 months. Then she flew to New Zealand and stayed with us for 6 months.
You sailed all the way to New Zealand.
Oh, well, we sailed around
the
world.
We sailed around the world, I know, yeah. But even when you break it down into actual spots, because it kind of rolls out, well, you know, we sailed around the world.
Yeah.
But you sailed around the world. I mean, that's huge.
Sometimes, you know, when I fly, like I fly to New Zealand now because my job is in New Zealand, I think, I look down, I see that vast Pacific. How do we do that at 4 knots or 5 knots or 6 knots, you know?
And it took 7 years to do the whole thing, but taking your time and stopping where you wanted for as long as you wanted. And was there?
We were never in a hurry.
Any long periods, like a year that you stayed somewhere?
We stayed in Papeete, Tahiti for a year, always living on board the boat. Andy got a really good job there ashore, and it was the first time my children went to school. We put them in real school, which was the best thing we could have done because they became fluent in French within a week. And so that was wonderful. And then after that wonderful year of living there, really becoming a part of the community, that's what I loved. And that's what the kids loved. We moved further west, and when we got to New Zealand, we did the same thing. We stayed in New Zealand. Andy got a job, and we put the kids in real school again.
They learned Kiwi in a week.
Yeah, and they started sounding like little, you know, Kiwis. Yeah, they did. They got that twang, you know. And then when we finally got Andy back to Australia, we did the same thing again. We always lived aboard the boat. I got a fabulous job in Sydney.
And did you meet up with his family now? You're in Australia?
His family had all passed away. It's so sad. We met up with his brothers and sisters-in-law, which was wonderful, just wonderful. But, you know, it was too bad his parents had passed away. So that's another reason why once we got into the Indian Ocean, beyond Australia, coming home, we were in a hurry because my dad was very ill, and we didn't want to lose him like we had lost Andy's family. So we kind of rushed through the Indian Ocean and around South Africa to get home as quickly as we could. And luckily, I got home just in time. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that's the only schedule we had was we didn't want to miss out on that.
How did your dad die?
He had a heart attack, just shortly after I came home. But he had been very sick up. He had other problems. But luckily I was here. But we enjoyed every place we stayed. We enjoyed the jobs we got there.
There was no tension, no fighting, no nothing between the two of you. It just was smooth sailing,
people,
as they say.
You know, it's so funny because I do a lot of women in cruising consulting and having workshops for women who are nervous and everything. And it's amazing how frightened a lot of women are because their mates, their husbands, their boyfriends, whatever it is, their significant others who sail with them, don't share with them the aspects of sailing. So they become passengers. And, of course, passengers who don't understand what's going on get frightened, right? You know what I mean? And a lot of them, you know, have to have special cabins to go into to get away from their men because they have emotional, you know, fallouts with them. And I can knock on wood here and say, Andy and I never, ever had any kind of a situation like that. I mean, we were just enjoying every minute all the time, you know. I think we were very lucky, but, of course, we were very well. I can't say we were matched. We were like, he was so different from me. He he wouldn't talk to you for anything. He was so private. He never spoke about himself. And he'd always make me do the talking, and he'd hide behind pillars when... And, you know what I mean? He wasn't a recluse, but he was shy, bashful, Not me, I'm out there,
Well, lucky, or the connection may not have occurred if
maybe.
You hadn't been...
Maybe, but we...
Look at me!
Yeah, that's right. There was still competition, but he was so good about teaching me. It wasn't like it was a class. It was like...
There was no talking down to you or authority.
Yeah. And that stood me in good stead over the years because of how I can help other people. And hopefully do it the same way he does it, without feeling any kind of an ego about it at all, but just wanting to share. That's it. That's the big thing, just share. So we came home, and we were home for 2 years, and our children obviously could not fit into real school here.
And how old are they now? Now they're 6 and 8? Or 9?
Yeah, no, they were Samantha was a teenager. She was...
You were gone for 6 years. That's right, yeah. So and you left when she was 4 and 7.
Yeah. So she was 13 when we came home.
Okay.
And Jamie was...
difficult time to try and...
Yeah. He was 11 and 10. And the reason they didn't fit in was because they were so free-willed all their lives. I mean, the education that they had... it was strict when they were in school in Papeete and New Zealand and Australia. It was an educational experience like most kids would have. But, I mean, like, they didn't know what football was or soccer or dances. I mean, these kids could windsurf and scuba dive and sail a dinghy and no other cultures. So
the educational system that they had experienced in New Zealand compared to the American, I mean, other than the sports and everything else, was that a completely different system that they were exposed to?
Yeah, but they were very young then, too, don't forget. So
yeah.
It wasn't like...
It wasn't more academics as much.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But the biggest problem they had here was their hands were always up. And, kids don't... if you're different, kids don't like you. And my kids could talk to an adult like an adult themselves. I mean, mm-hmm. they were curious, they were interested in other people, and they were certainly not bashful, these two kids. And so, if a teacher asked a question, their hand would be up where everybody else would look at them And they did not get along here. They did not know. My daughter, who was a beautiful girl at 13, she looked a lot like you, Sarah. Mm-hmm. Long blonde hair, really beautiful, kind of shy like her dad, but... she was sexually harassed. She was caught in the bathrooms, the girls were trying to get her to smoke. They had drug problems here. Don't think they didn't. And I put her in a really good Catholic school, which is just as bad as any other school. And she said, "Mom, I don't mind being a foreigner in a foreign country, but I don't like being a foreigner in my home. Please, can I go to school in France, please?" So luckily, Rotary, which has a wonderful youth exchange program, sent her to France to school. And then Jamie said, "If Santa can go to France, I want to go to France." But he was too young to be with Rotary. Rotary wouldn't take him. So we sailed him over. We had met some wonderful people when we were in France. And we sailed him over there. And he lived with a family there and went to school. And the kids just loved being in school in France.
So you sailed him over to France and off
I
he goes to school.
Yeah,
then
Sammy
where'd you go?
There. Pardon me?
Sammy was there, and now Jamie's there.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Sammy staying with a family as well and doing that whole thing?
Yes, because Rotary puts you with families.
I see.
Rotary family. And during the time that she was with Rotary, we had to have students here.
Oh, so you did the exchange thing.
Yeah.
I got you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they both went to school over there, and we sailed Jamie over. Actually, Sammy came with us, that's right, because it was her school holidays. It was summertime, across the Atlantic in the summer. And then we came back home, sailed back home, and
Jamie's like, I want to come home.
No, he didn't want to come home. I told him he had to come home. When he finished high school, I said, you've got to do college here. You've got to get, you know, if you want to, you know, if you want to live here and work here, you've got to get a degree here. So he did. He came home, and Samantha came home. Although they spent the first year of Samantha's college in Toulouse, they lived together. I think Jamie was more a playboy than anything. Samantha was studying, and I finally said to him, you both got to come home and dig into education now, which they did, and very well. They did very well, so it was fine. Jamie went to Rhode Island School of Design on a scholarship, full scholarship. He's now an architect on South Beach. And Samantha went to Nova Southeastern University here in Fort Lauderdale and became a child psychologist and worked for the state of Maine for, I think, 7 years as a child psychologist working with handicapped, autistic, handicapped and battered children. So they both followed what they had enjoyed all their lives. Jamie was always interested in architecture. It's amazing. No matter where we were, no matter what his age was, he wanted to go see all the ruins and the cathedrals and the homes, and you know, and Samantha always wanted to be with the children who really were so.
Isn't that wonderful though? They get exposed to so many different things. You are able to find what it is that you love. When you have this one thing with blinders on, how do you really find what's in your heart?
I think it would be more difficult. I think it would be. I mean, she saw so many poor children that didn't have homes, that didn't have clothes, that didn't have food. Especially when we were in Indonesia and South Africa and Madagascar and places like that. So she really wanted to help children who needed help. So they both fell into it. Well, yeah, I shouldn't say fell into it. They sought out what they wanted to do in life. And were both of them hopefully very successful. I mean, I think they were successful. I don't mean financially so much as I mean
happy,
fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is Jamie still sailing now?
Oh, yeah, Jamie and I, we sail together all the time. Mm. I mean, I shouldn't say that, because he's so busy trying to establish himself as an architect, a well-known architect. So we go out on weekends. Like, we just spent the weekend on Biscayne Bay. We anchored off of Key Biscayne for the night and went sailing all over. It was so much fun.
Does he have children?
No, he's not married or anything. He's got a girl in every port.
Still a playboy.
Still very much a playboy. Yeah. So, but it's my children were my best friends, always. And I think it's because we live so close to each other, you know, so close
to
each other.
So Samantha died of cancer.
Right.
Right?
Right.
How do you deal with that?
I don't. I still
no, you
die.
Don't. Mm-mm. How long ago was that?
It was in 2013.
Okay. Oh, so just 3 years ago.
Yeah. Oh. I don't deal with it.
No.
At least I don't deal with it with you. I have my demons, and I don't think they'll ever leave me.
No.
Ever.
Nor any mother.
No, no. They'll
child.
Get softer, probably, and the edges will be a little rounded, you know, but it'll never end. The same thing with losing Andy.
When did he die?
There was nothing I could do about it. It just happened so fast. With Samantha, you know, you're always thinking, well, what more could we have done? What more could we have done? I'll always be thinking that.
And well, how long was it from you found out that she had cancer that you were fighting it and going through that whole process of trying
right
to survive? But how long was the whole thing from beginning to end?
For Samantha?
Yeah.
About 4 years of, you know, chemotherapy, radiation, tremendous surgeries. And then we'd feel as though we had whacked it, and then a year later it would come again. And then she went through 3 series of major surgical neck resections and chemotherapy and radiation, and always thought that we had flicked it and then it would come back.
Hmm.
And the last one was just too much. It was just...
It just got her.
You know. So...
So Andy, was he alive for this? No.
Thank goodness.
So you did it on your own.
He could not have taken it. Because, you know, like a lot of families, my son and I were the closest, and he and his daughter were the closest. You know, it's all, you know, it always seems to happen like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there was any dichotomy anywhere. It's just that...
just happened that way.
Yeah. I mean, he couldn't have lived through what I had to live through. And
but
so,
you had to deal with it on your own, which is... Well, you had Jamie.
I had Jamie, but he was working hard and trying to earn a living and start his business. And but he, believe me, he was right there with me every minute, Jamie. He was making decisions. When we took Samantha to Memorial Sloan Kettering, he was in Marrakesh doing some architecture there, and he flew home on New Year's Day because we finally got an appointment. To get an appointment there is, you know...
With the right doctor,
And so he flew home from Marrakesh. He made all the plane reservations for me and Sammy to fly up there, hotel reservations, so that we could all meet up on the 2nd of January and go there. And, you know, so he was my backbone. I was Samantha's...
support, everything.
Support, yeah.
Yeah.
And caregiver.
Yeah.
It's something...
Yeah.
May no one ever know what I have been through, because the only way you could know it is to go through it, and you don't want anyone else to know it, ever. To see someone you love so much suffer so much.
I know.
And to try to do everything you possibly can and then not have it work. You know.
And then for somebody like me, the temptation is to say you're sorry, but really, it's, I can't even fathom it.
No.
No matter what you say, it doesn't matter.
No, but it's something that I have to live with. And, you know, what I love doing is talking about them and keeping them alive for other people as well as for myself. And I really should sell this house, you know, and move into something smaller. But I'm not going to, because this is all my life.
It's got so much going on
in
it still, and always will. Now, a lot of, I feel, of what you were saying was that you regret letting things hold you back from just going. Like you would pause because you have this responsibility to do or that responsibility to do. Whereas in hindsight now, you kind of would have been, you would have felt that you could have easily gone way before you did.
You know, when I give seminars, which I love doing across the country, I always say to people, get out there fast. Don't, you know, you can always add on to your boat or subtract from your boat or buy what you want after you get what you need. But, you know, don't put it off. I mean, if we had put it off, look what happened. Andy died when we got home. You know, if we had put it off, it would have been horrible. And that's my biggest lesson is go while you can. Go while you have the energy. Go while you have the... you don't have to have the means. You don't have to have the means. I mean, we worked our way around the world, and it was
fun. So, yeah, when you say you worked your way around the world, what kind of jobs would you do when you stopped in these places?
Well, we picked them up. I mean, it was...
Like
you
what?
Don't advertise that you're looking for work. You never advertise because you can't work legally in foreign countries.
Right.
So, like in Tahiti, we met a cruiser who lived in Papeete, and he had a beautiful woodworking business, and he came aboard the boat for dinner, and he said, "Who built this boat?" And Andy said, "I did." He said, "Did you do these joints and all?" And Andy said, "Of course, yes." And he said, "Would you like to come to work for me?" And Andy said, "Well, sure," because Tahiti was so expensive to us. So expensive. And then I wanted to go buy, you know, some Pareos and things like that. And I went into this tiny little store, and there was a very nice Chinese man there, which is a chinoise. And I bought a whole bunch of Pareo material because it was so beautiful. And I became his good friend, and I would come in and I would try to speak French with him, and he would try to speak English with me. And then he finally said to me, "Would you teach me English?" Because I could speak French. And so once a day, I would, after I took my kids to school, my two kids went to two different schools. So I'd walk them to these schools. I'd go to Frank Muguet's place, and we'd go upstairs, and this attic of his shop was just filled with bolts and bolts and bolts of this gorgeous Pareo material.
Mm.
And it just smelled good. It smelled like Pekaki or jasmine or something, and we'd go up there and I'd teach him English, and he would improve my French. And His name was Frank. And I said, Frank, why is your name Frank instead of Francois or something?
Right.
And he said, he told me that his father was a cook on the U.S. Navy ships during the war. And he met so many nice Americans on the Navy ships. He had 9 children, his father. And they were all named American names after people that were on these ships that they were so fun. He said, that's why I wanted to ask you to teach me to speak English, because you're an American. And not many Americans come into my store. So I've got to tell you a story about Frank. He had a sister named Caroline, okay, who lived in New Caledonia, which is much further west across the Pacific, but it's also a French-speaking island. And he said, when you get to New Caledonia, you've got to look up my sister Caroline. And, you know, we didn't get to New Caledonia for 2.5 years later. So, and I totally forgot that he even had a sister there. And we're anchored in this beautiful little bay with palm trees. And ashore, there's a petite magasin, which is a tiny, like a 7-Eleven. But, you know, when you're in a French island, you've got to have fresh baguette every morning. You can't eat a baguette you bought the day before. So we rode ashore, and every store has fresh baguettes. And we went in, and behind the counter was this very petite, very beautiful chinoise, for French lady. And we're checking out with our cheese, our president butter, and our fresh hot baguettes, and our camembert cheese. And she looks at Andy, kind of, because Andy was really tall, and then she looks down at me, and then she looks at the 2 kids, and she said, Pamela? And she said to me in French, are you Pamela?
No way.
She said, I've been waiting for you. Isn't that amazing? And I said to her, are you Frank? Look, I goosebumps. I said, are you Frank's sister, Caroline? And she says, oui, bien sûr, of course, you know. And can you believe it?
Amazing.
She closed the shop down. We went up to her house, and she gave us lunch, which I've never had before. Have you ever had fresh avocados on French bread that's, first of all, smeared with butter, and then you've got the avocado on top of that, fresh, and then you squeeze a lime from the tree on it? Best sandwich.
I'm going to have it for dinner tonight.
God, it is so good. Anyway, so we stayed in that bay for a week, and isn't that amazing? We just
found each other.
Just found each other. But you know what? That happened a lot.
You know, I think it's because when you're open and free, you can allow things to happen, and they will happen.
It does.
And if you do
though,
what you love, that's how it goes.
That's right. And it's not that you look for adventure. It falls in your lap, kind of. And, I mean, many, many times, strange, weird, and wonderful things happen to us with people that somehow or other we knew but had never known. Do you know what I mean? It was weird. And the other great thing is children open doors for you. I mean, in the Panama Canal Zone, everybody gets mugged when they leave the enclosed, locked up boatyard. They get mugged when they go shopping. Not when you have 2 children. They leave you alone if you have 2 children. Andy and I never got mugged, but we always had these 2 little blonde kids with us. And they were very young then. And people would come and want to borrow Samantha and Jamie for the day to go shopping.
So they wouldn't get mugged.
And they did. They'd always, you know,
$50 a kid.
That's right. Well, they'd get ice creams, you know, and stuff like that. And my kids always wanted to go with them because they gave them treats that I never would, you know. And the kids became really, really popular. And that's honestly what happened in Panama. Then we get to the Galapagos Islands. And in those days, back in 1985, it was, you were only allowed to stay 72 hours. You had to, what they called, revictualize. In other words, get water, fuel, food, and leave. And when we went to check in with the 2 little kids, the Capitaine du Port, we said, please, is there any chance that we could stay longer? I had been writing to the Minister of Defense in Quito, Ecuador, requesting permission to cruise as an educational cruise in the Galapagos, but I never got the permission. So he asked me to show him the correspondence, which I did. And we went back the next day, and he said, I am going to give you permission to cruise the Galapagos, but only on one condition. If you come for dinner tonight because this is a hardship post. And I have two little boys who are the exact same age as your children, and they haven't seen any children in 6 months. And so that's, we said, that's the condition? He said, that's the condition.
We can manage that.
Yeah. So we got to, we were the only boat that was allowed to stay. And then we cruised all over the Galapagos because the Capitaine de Port wanted some friends for his kids when we would come back and check in and check out. I mean, you know.
Beautiful.
That's the kind of thing that happens when you have little kids. You know, seriously, doors are open. We get to Ascension Island, which is in the middle of the South Atlantic Ocean. And there's a mountain there called Green Mountain. There's not much else. It's a Air Force base. And we're walking down Green Mountain, and this pickup truck goes past us really fast. And then it jams on the brakes and backs up. And it stops right next to Samantha, who by now is, you know, 12 years old and absolutely magnificent. And it's a young kid. He gets out and he says to Samantha, not to us, would you like a ride down the mountain? And she looked at us, see you, Dad. Yeah. But he said, oh, they can sit in the back, you know, because it was a pickup. They can sit in the back. I'll take them. But you can sit next to me. Well, it turns out he's the governor's son who lives on the top of Green Mountain in the governor's mansion. And he's going somewhere. And then he invites us up to dinner, and we get to meet the governor's wife and everything like that. And then she says to us, would you like me to do your laundry for you? You know, so we bring out laundry. And every night we did something with the governor and his wife and his son because of Samantha. You know, it was brilliant. It was brilliant.
Does she remember that? Did she remember it and talk about it?
Of course she did.
Yeah.
And he was adorable. He was just her age, you know. Well, no, he wasn't. He was older because he was 16. He was driving. And it was just so much fun because of that family. Then we get to another little island called Christmas Island. And Christmas Island had a new airport, and the airport was up on the top of the mountain as well. And the airplane comes in from Australia once a week, and everybody goes to see the plane land. It's just the big thing there because there's nothing else to do, right? Mm. So we took a taxi up to the airport. It wasn't with a taxi like you and I know. It was a Land Rover that drove us up there. And it's really, really foggy up there. I mean, pea soup fog. And there's all these cars. And we see one car that kind of stands out because it's a really old black Mercedes. And nobody has Mercedes on it. And there is a woman standing there biting her fingernails, leaning against the car. And I said, is someone flying in? Because the airport was socked in. She says, yes, my two children are on that plane coming back from Australia.
In the fog.
With 35 other children. You know, they've gone on a trip to Australia as a school event. And she says, I'm really nervous because, you know, they're committed. They have to land. They can't get back to Australia. And I said, don't worry. I'm sure it'll be okay. So the plane tries to land. We all are there alongside the runway. This is the whole island, you know, 300 people. And the plane comes in and can't land and takes off again. Well, she starts to cry. So I go over and start hugging her and saying, I know it'll be okay. I'm sure he's used to this, you know. Don't worry about it. And we start hugging each other. And the father's a wreck, and Andy's there, and Samantha and Jamie are saying, it'll be okay, it'll be okay. And the plane comes in and lands. And all these kids come out, and all their parents are going, hug them like. And as we were waiting for somebody to give us a ride back down the mountain, because all we do is just stand there and sort of wave to people, and if they stop, they take us down. And their Mercedes came by and said, come on, jump in. Why don't you come and have a cup of tea with us? And it was the governor of Christmas Island.
So, another governor.
Another governor. So we went there, and they asked, by the time that it was time to leave for tea, the kids said, oh, could Sammy and Jamie please have a sleepover? We want them to stay. So we stayed, and we enjoyed their company. We stayed for dinner, and the kids stayed and slept overnight. And then we were together the whole time we were there. And it was so funny because every afternoon we had to go to tea to the governor's house. And, you know, here we are anchored with all these other boats. And we'd say, you know, people would say, do you want to have a drink or you want to have dinner? And we said, I'm sorry. We
go to the governor for some tea.
You know, they call it the big house. And, you know, they go, yeah, you know. But they were wonderful, wonderful people. And it was because of our kids.
And because you were able to show some sympathy in a situation that was pretty dire.
Well, that too. But, I mean, anybody should have done it. That poor woman was hysterical. All the mothers were hysterical. And I would have been too. It was a DC-3, for goodness sake. No radar or anything. Of course, the pilots were really good. But anyway, so that's the kind of thing that happens, you know.
Amazing. So what would you say to somebody, me, I'm not a sailor, I'll go for an old sail somewhere. How do I start?
You come sailing with me, for one. Okay, what you got to do is, what I would do if I were you, okay, I would, there's like Gulfstream Sailing Club here is always looking for people to go sailing with them. Hillsborough Inlet Sailing Club, what a wonderful group of people. They're up in Hillsborough. They're always looking for people to go sailing with them. I would try to rub shoulders with people who are sailors somehow or other, with yacht clubs or something like that, or sailing clubs. They don't have to be yacht clubs, but sailing clubs. And like both of those clubs don't have clubhouses. You can become a member, not be a sailor. It's just a sailing club. Coconut Grove Sailing Club.
And then they're looking for crew, and then you just jump on and you just learn as you go.
I'm just saying, a lot of them have sailing lessons that you could go on. You know, all of those places, and I try to belong to all of them just because I like to mingle, you know, are wonderful people, enthusiastic sailors, and they want to share their enthusiasm with people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a good way, or go to the boat shows. If you were to go to the St. Petersburg Boat Show the first week in December and come to all my seminars, you would be surrounded by people who are just like you, because they go to the seminars to learn. The people who know what they're doing don't go to the seminars. It's the people who want to learn. And sometimes it is the people who know what they're doing because they're my friends and they come just to be with me. Do you know what I mean? Boat shows have great seminars. Miami Boat Show will be coming up in February. St. Petersburg is going to have a great big one. You just missed one in Melbourne, the Seven Seas Cruising Association Cam. All those kind of places are, you know, have lots and lots of people who want to help, who are enthusiastic.
So if it's something you want to do, this is a way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a group on Facebook called Women Who Sail, you know, who help each other, you know, go sailing. Help edit another Facebook page called Women in Cruising, you know, and it's for women or those two, because they are women oriented. Are to help women get out there and do it, and that's a good way of doing it. I think.
Now your boat, you just went out this weekend. Are you going to hang on to this boat? You'll keep that forever before you keep the house.
Yeah, but Jamie wants the boat.
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah, he wants it, so that's fine with me.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, of course he wants to do all kinds of things that I would never do, but he wants to put a generator in it and all of that.
Well, he's got to keep all his women happy.
Yeah, right. You know, when I'm gone, he can do whatever he wants. I'm keeping it simple. It's a simple boat. I'm used to it, you know. So says to me when he's like his daddy, 6'3", and he sees the little bunk he slept in. He said, how did I ever live in this boat? You know, I said, you were a little kid, Jamie. You know, I have the cutest pictures of him because we made their bunks with curtains, like Pullman curtains in the old trains, because that was like their cabin. And each of their bunks had a fan and a light and a bookshelf and these curtains that were closed. And I had pictures of, you know, peeking out from their curtains. So cute. Kids are so cute.
They're so cute.
And, you know, they're so adaptable, much more adaptable than adults.
So what are you up to now?
Well, you know, I came home and I got a job with West Marine. That was in 1991 when we came home. And I got a job at the second store east of the Mississippi in Fort Lauderdale. I worked for them for 22 years. And when Samantha passed away, I lost my job with West Marine because I had to be with her. And I was pretty much in the dumps. No, I was in a cavern, a pit, of despair. Because not only did I lose my husband and my daughter, and the horrific 3 years of watching her fade, and then I lost the job that was like a family to me. And Andy and I had never saved a penny. So I was having a difficult job keeping this house. And a cruising friend of mine, very famous man back in the 60s and 70s, his name is Steve Dashy. As a matter of fact, see all those red books up there?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote all of those books. Very famous sailor.
Hmm.
And he was a friend that I hadn't heard from in a long time. Called me up and said, "You didn't tell me you weren't working for West Marine anymore." And he said, "I don't tell anybody because I'm so devastated." He said, "Well, I want you to start working for me tomorrow."
Yes.
And I said, "Doing what?" And he said, "Well, I'm building these aluminum mega yachts in New Zealand now, and I need someone here in the States to purchase everything. And you've been doing that all your life at West Marine. And I want you to start tomorrow, and I'm going to fly you to New Zealand to see the boats and to meet the customers that buy the boats from us." And I've been working for him ever since. And it's actually a year. I've had my year anniversary already with him.
Mm.
It was October 19th that I started working for him.
So you had that time that you needed to be with her. Of course, not get over, but the initial shock. And then this person walks into your life.
It's like, I always said, "Steve, you're manna from heaven." Because number one, it's something I'm good at. Number two, it's something I really know how to do. Number three, I can work from home. I don't have to punch a time clock. Number four, occasionally I get to go to New Zealand. And number five, he's fabulous to work with. He's like working with Einstein in the boating industry. He's just so brilliant. And we're birds of a feather. We enjoy the same things. And he's so smart. It's just scary, you know. And I'm learning from him, which is great. I love learning from him. And so I wouldn't be sitting here with you if I was in a job where I had to punch a time card.
No, I couldn't see that working for you.
You know?
Mm-mm.
No. So it's perfect. And I'm a lucky person. I'm a very lucky person. And I got to always focus on that. So I do. And it's not hard. It's not hard.
Well, Pam Wall, it has been an amazing chat. Thank you for giving me the time and your thoughts. And good luck with everything that's to come in your life. Well, I'm sure there's plenty.
You know, I feel, Sarah, as though I've met a new friend.
I do, too.
That's the best thing in the world, you know. It's like dealing a pack of cards and getting an ace, you
mm-hmm.
know. And I'd like you to come sailing with me on my boat.
Oh, I would love to.
You know?
And you can direct me all over the place.
Right. And thank you so much for reaching out to me. And I appreciate it. And I just, I'd like to end with telling people that, you know, if you have a dream and you don't follow it, you could lose it. And the most important thing is, I think, in life is, you know, maybe not to be financially secure, but to have a bank full of experiences. To me, that's the thread of life.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.